I've lost count of the time over the decades that we've discussed Mahatma Gandhi, aspects of his life, of course, his role in Indian independence, the tragedy of partition, his influence on the likes of Luther King, Mandela, and the Dalai Lama, who incidentally is about to make a return visit to the Antipodes. A lesser fact is that Gandhi's work also inspired the ideas of unheralded Muslim leaders of India's independence movement. One was Abdul Azad, a Muslim scholar and senior political leader in the independence movement, and the other, Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, was a Pashtun political and spiritual leader. Now, they were both to a great degree influenced and changed by the ideas of the Mahatma. And as my next guest says, their work is an example to people today who doubt the viability of non-violent Islamic protest. So does the world today need the teachings of Gandhi more than ever before, especially in the face of radical Islam? And what can Muslim leaders learn from Gandhi and from the non-violent contribution of Muslim activists of the past? Iranian philosopher Ramin Jahan Begli is Associate Professor and New York Chair in Islamic Studies at the York University in Toronto. He's the author of The Gandhian Moment, a book I find immensely therapeutic and, I have to say, optimistic, and I'm delighted to welcome him via the phone line from Toronto in Canada. Ramin, you believe that we're living through a Gandhian moment. Why?
Yes, hello. I think that there has been several Gandhi moments, actually in the past 60 years after the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. What I mean exactly by the Gandhi moment is the moments of strategic nonviolence, the moments of what we call negotiated politics, negotiated revolutions. Very recently, we had it with the Arab Spring in Egypt and Tunisia, and previously we had it with Mandela in South Africa, and before that in Eastern Europe with people like Havel and others. So I think that the Gandhi moment is a moment of what I call the shared sovereignty, moment of democratization of democracies, moment of transition from dictatorships to democracies through nonviolent means. And as we can see today with some of the leaders like Aung San Suu Kyi also around the world, this Gandhi moment, this heritage legacy of Gandhi, the political legacy, has been very, very relevant for our world as a new way of transition from dictatorship to democracy.
Well, as you say, in our increasingly violent world of religious, ethnic, racial prejudices, these successful experiments in militant nonviolence seem to be laying the foundations of a new cosmopolitics. Cosmopolitics.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have to be very conscious about the fact that we need to go back and read Gandhi. We need to go back and look at these experiences. Otherwise, we have to repeat the violence that we have in our modern politics as it has been practiced, especially in 20th century and in the beginning of the 21st century. So I think its legacy has to do more with the way we look and we define politics, so not only as an art of power making, but also as an art of organizing our societies and sharing and caring for others. And I think that it's each time that we would need to rethink about the strategies of change in our world, we need to go and take a look at the Gandhian legacy. When I call the Gandhian legacy, I'm talking about Luther King also, or even some Muslims who have been in this, have taken this itinerary and political itinerary, and they have been non-violent. So I think that to get out of the stereotypes and to get out of the classical way of making power in politics, we need this Gandhi moment.
Let's look at one of the very first Gandhian moments, because as you point out, his ideas inspired leading Muslim activists in India. For example, tell us how Gandhi managed to turn the once Muslim fundamentalist thinking of Abdul Azad into a secular nationalist.
Well, that's the trick. I mean, that's the whole point. First of all, it has to do with the character of Gandhi himself, a man who was a religious pluralist, open-minded, open to every religion. He used to read not only the Vedas, but also the Gathas of the Zoroastrians and the Bible and the New Testament and also the Quran. So I think this dialogue between Gandhi and the Muslims already started when he was in South Africa, and when he went back in 1915 to India to start the independent movement, I think he wanted the Muslims, especially the Muslim League, to be on his side. Of course, there were also a lot of debates between people like Jinnah, who later on was the founder of Pakistan, and people like Gandhi. But I think Gandhi was able to influence many of these Muslim leaders, like Maulana Azad, and who became later in Nehru's first government, he became the Minister of Education, and Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who is named after Gandhi as the Frontier Gandhi. And I think the interesting story about this is that not only they learned from Gandhi, they learned about nonviolence and other strategies. Gandhi actually says that he learned a lot about them, about Islam through them.
Well, as you say in the book, turning battle-ready Pathans into a 50,000-strong force of completely non-violent servants of God was nothing short of miraculous.
Yes, miraculous. I think that, as I mentioned in the book, and I really believe that, people like Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who actually try to get nonviolence out of their faith, are very important symbols, political symbols and political icons for today's Muslim world. I mean, look at the stereotypes that we have today in Australia, for example, in Europe, the stereotypes of a Muslim, of Islam, and Islam is considered as a violent religion, you know. But I think because we don't know that there has been experiences of people who have tried to read Islam with the eyes of a nonviolent strategy, and it helped them actually very much to collaborate and cooperate with people like Mahatma Gandhi and bring in the independence to India.
My guest is Rahman Jahanbegloo, and this is LNL on RN. Persuade me that Gandhi was relevant to Muslim societies, with particular emphasis on the Iranian Revolution of 2009. I can't quite see that.
Well, I mean, Gandhi, I think, has been relevant not only to Iran, but to many other experiences in the Middle East. As I mentioned previously, the Arab Spring, and we know that the Egyptian writers and the revolutionaries, actually, they read Gandhi, and they read a lot, Eugene Sharp and others, about nonviolent strategies. As for what you call the Revolution of 2009, which was a civic movement, I think every civic movement around the world, especially in the Middle East today, if it wants to not to go back to the idea of violence and violent transition, Gandhi is certainly one of the required readings. And the Gandhi movement, the Gandhi strategy, I would say, is very much suggested and required. And most of the civic actors, as we can see, if they want to get into a negotiated revolution, a compromise like we had it in South Africa with Mandela, or we have it today in Burma, they do the same thing.
Okay, I'll accept the argument that we see Gandhian inspiration in Egypt and other parts of the Arab Spring, but I'm more intrigued when you write that the importance of Gandhi's practical achievements has obscured his stature as an extraordinarily innovative political thinker. Was his political genius an ability to get ordinary citizens to see the need for taking greater responsibility and in challenging their leaders?
Yes, absolutely, because what we miss in Gandhi, and it started with his book in Swaraj already in 1909, are two aspects. One is a theoretical aspect. Gandhi is a very, I would say, profound critique of our civilization as in the way we live it today. But at the same time, there is a practical side to it. So which Gandhi shows us, and even he tried to, and his followers also tried to apply, I would say, these methods after the Indian independence, is how to get to this shared sovereignty, how to get to more democracy. Even today in India, I think the Gandhians, they try to democratize Indian democracy through economic means, through political means, and through social means. The question of equality, welfare of all, but also the self-rule has always been very important concepts in Gandhian mind.
Okay, one can clearly see Gandhi's influence in the civil rights movement in the United States, and a more recent echo perhaps in the Occupy. The Occupy movements in the US and elsewhere. You go so far as to say that his current influence is at least as great as Mao, Churchill, Lenin, Roosevelt.
Not as that much, but I think that Gandhi has always been an inspiration for social movements, maybe less for some politicians. I think eventually, if I have to name a few politicians in the past 30 years who have been directly influenced by Gandhi, I would mention, as I did it already, Mandela, Havel.
Yeah, no, I wasn't suggesting that Mao, Churchill, Lenin, or Roosevelt were Gandhian, simply that they were other immensely influential, citizens of the 20th century.
I don't think that they have been influential as much as Gandhi, because there is a posterity for Gandhi, which is not the same as for Churchill. Nobody goes and reads Churchill today. And maybe many high school students, they don't know even who's Roosevelt. But everybody has heard about the name of Gandhi. I mean, they know that Gandhi represents nonviolence in today's world. So that's very important.
There's another aspect of Gandhi, which I think is of urgent relevance, and that is His views about the environment, because his economic model of trusteeship espoused environmentally friendly and appropriate technologies.
Yes, absolutely. And we have to understand that on this level, Gandhi has influenced many economists, and he has influenced also many scientists. We have examples of people like Vandana Shiva. She's a scientist, but she fights against reductionist science. She uses Gandhi as for what she calls the Earth Democracy. Actually, I did a book very recently with her, which is called Talking Environment.
She's been a guest on the program from time to time.
Okay, yeah. More the reason. So, she's a Gandhian also, and when we go and see that there are books like Small is Beautiful, and in the 60s, Gandhi has a lot of influence on people like Ivan Illich and others. I think that not only the educational aspects of Gandhi are relevant for today's world, but also we have his approaches to the environment, his approaches to the problem of nature, of the way technology has to be used. And I think that the interesting side to it is that many people who want to have alternative ways of looking at today's world, they go back and read Gandhi and use this Gandhian experience as a tool to rethink our world.
It's interesting that he avoided the use of metaphors like state or nationalism, but preferred to use words like one's own cultural and ecological space. But of course, his desperate effort to spiritualize politics met with a lot of opposition. You mentioned Jinnah,
yes,
of course, but there are other members of the independence movement who found Gandhi a real pain in the neck.
Well, because I do think that it's important to mention state and nationalism. But I mean, Gandhi was not necessarily a nationalist. He was more of a cosmopolitan, and he was a critique of nationalism, as in forms of fanatic ways of looking outlooks that we might describe. But at the same time, I think that it's very important when we go and read Hind Swaraj, which is his important book written when he was in South Africa.
Yeah.
He defines civilization as a moral conduct and not necessarily as technology, science, progress, you know, the ways.
Well, you've just mentioned perhaps the most important part of his philosophy. True civilization is not a linear progression towards greater prosperity as far as Gandhi was concerned.
Absolutely. And that explains everything for your listeners, because I think that already means if we redefine civilization not necessarily as technological progress, we try to define it in terms of morality and ethics, it means that we need to rethink the state, we need to rethink politics, and we need to rethink our approach towards nature and our approach towards the whole, planet. So this is where Gandhi becomes also very relevant.
Ramin, a final question. How difficult was it to be a philosopher in modern Iran?
Iran has had a tradition of philosophers, and there are many philosophers living inside and outside Iran. But I think that the true task of philosophy is a civic task and a critical task. So anywhere in the world, as in Iran today, if there are political problems and you need to rethink the society, I think you have philosophers which are very active. And that's my case too.
Well, I'm very pleased that you've taken the time out of your busy schedule to write The Gandhian Moment. It's a very, very optimistic and, I think, profoundly important book. My guest, Ramin Jahanbegloo, Associate Professor and the Chair in Islamic Studies at New York University in Toronto. His book under discussion is, yes, The Gandhian Moment, published by Harvard University Press. That's the program for today. For more information on any of our programs, just whack Late Night Live into your search engine. Don't forget you can hear over 200 of the more historic interviews from the past 20-odd years on our online retrospective called In Bed with Philip, and just put the words into your search engine. On our next, we'll be looking at the need for another Iraq War Inquiry, which could keep us out of any future conflicts. It'll be a very controversial program, I suspect, and I'll be talking about, of all things, sport, a subject I like to shun, with journalist and author Martin Flanagan and musician and composer David Bridie. That's it for now. Stick around on RN, and we will see you later.